Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
CUNY adjunct professor and doctoral candidate of philosophy Ian Olazoff wants to change the perception that philosophy is disconnected from issues that matter to people. A few years back, he started setting up Ask a Philosopher booths at farmers markets around New York City, where he would sit with a fellow philosopher and wait for people to walk up and ask whatever pressing questions they had. In March, the booth went digital as live streams on Facebook. Olazoff joined us last year for a radio call-in edition of Ask a Philosopher, and he returns to answer more of your questions today, which also happens to be the pub day for his new book, Ask a Philosopher, Answers to Your Most Important and Most Unexpected Questions. And with him is Denise Vigani, assistant professor of philosophy at Seton Hall University, who specializes in virtue, ethics, and moral psychology, and who's joined Ian at the Ask a Philosopher desk many times. Denise, welcome.
Thank you.
And Ian, welcome back and happy publishing day.
Thank you so much. It's so good to be here.
So, Ian, you describe your work as public philosophy. What does it mean to be a public philosopher? What is public philosophy?
Well, I think there are a lot of different ways of doing public philosophy. You can write or speak for a general audience. You can collaborate with community groups and activists like my colleague Mike Menzer at Brooklyn College, his work with the Participatory Budgeting Project. You can do multimedia. You can start podcasts. You know, there's all sorts of ways of doing public philosophy, but they all involve in some way engaging with people outside of universities who are sort of traditionally excluded from, you know, the practice of philosophy the way it's been understood by a lot of people.
How did the Brooklyn Public Philosophers Project turn into a book?
I think this radio show actually had a big role to play in it. I think my editor at St. Martin's, Stephen Powers, contacted me after this, and that was that. I mean, you know, we've gotten a lot of questions over the years, and you know, to some extent, the book kind of wrote itself because we'd already had so many conversations with so many people, and it was so wide ranging, and so. You know, hopefully the book can do a little bit to kind of invite people into that space or give people a sense of, you know, what those conversations were like.
Denise, how did you get involved with the Brooklyn Public Philosophers and public philosophy in general?
So I know Ian from graduate school, the doctoral program in philosophy at CUNY's Graduate Center. And he sent out a call saying, I'm going to do this thing. I'm going to set up this booth. We're going to see what happens. And it sounded great. It sounded really interesting. And one day I just took the plunge. I said, yes, sign me up. I want to give this a shot. And it was so rewarding. I mean, every time we do it, I think it's a great experience.
Now, Denise, your website says your work in philosophy is based on, quote, empirically oriented research in psychology and cognitive science. So for you, what's the difference between a philosophical question and a scientific question?
Good. So science has particular methodologies. Scientists try to evaluate evidence based on observation to answer questions. Philosophers don't have that kind of methodology, right? So a lot of my work is saying, well, look, for example, I work in virtue. Virtue is committed to the idea that there are character traits. Well, scientists, right, cognitive scientists, psychologists, they have lots of things to say about character traits, and they've used empirical methods. They do studies, they do surveys, they observe people, and they've got data that tells us things. And so the things that we think about in philosophy when it comes to what we think character traits are and how we think they operate in humans, we need to be sensitive to that data. And so kind of incorporating the descriptive data that we might get from science about how people are into thinking about more normative questions in philosophy about, well, what kinds of humans do we want to be? And what does a good human life look like?
We've got a call already on line one from Chelsea Shari. And Shari has a question, which I know you tackle in your book, Ian. So let's go to Shari. Hi, Shari. Thanks for calling all of it.
Hi, how are you all?
What's your question?
Great, thanks.
Well, it's a kind of combination question. And part of it is that a couple of years ago, I attended this school of practical philosophy, which I think is a school of practical BS. But I began to notice there that they worship Plato, but they don't seem to know the difference between objective truth and subjective truth. So I was wondering, A, if there is a difference, and B, because of the current administration that we're in under, they have begun to blur the lines, and how do we stay focused on actual truth?
Is there objective truth? What does that mean to you, Ian?
Yeah, so I think the words objective and subjective are understood in a lot of different ways by a lot of different people. One thing that you can mean by subjective is that truth is subjective if it's in part about yourself, right? So the fact that something is to the left of something else is only true relative to my point of view. Nothing is objectively to the left of anything else. It's only relative to the point of view of some person or other. And objective truths are different. They're not just relative to a person. So, you know, one thing might be heavier than another, for example, not just relative to a point of view, but full stop. So, you know, I think if that's the case, then, and that's how we understand what subjectivity is, then sure, plenty of truths are objective. Plenty of what we talk about isn't ourselves. I mean, as for, you know, the kind of state of public discourse today and, you know, how people mix up subjective and objective truths, you know, for reasons which may or may not have something to do with the president, I think that sometimes we frame the problem with public discourse as a matter of being post-truth, as if people don't care about the truth at all. You know, people only care about, I don't know, you know, their own feelings, you know, rooting for their own team, whatever it is. But I think people do care about the truth. They just have very different views about how to get at it, which experts to trust, what sorts of sources are reliable, you know, what ways of finding out about the world make sense. Denise, do you have any thoughts about this?
I was also thinking that one way in which we can think about subjectivity is the way in which I see things from my perspective, right? And my perspective is going to be limited in various ways. And so one thing that looking to objective truth can kind of remind us to do too is that stepping outside of our perspective and acknowledging that someone else from a different perspective may see things differently because they come from a different perspective. And oftentimes, right, Nietzsche has this line about the more seeing, the more objectivity, right? If we can see things from multiple perspectives, we get a better sense of what that thing looks like, sort of objectively.
The subject today is Ask a Philosopher. My guests are Ian Ozoff. His new book is Ask a Philosopher, Answers to Your Most Important and Most Unexpected Questions. And Denise Vigani is joining us, professor at Seton Hall University. If you have a philosophical question you would like to pose to our two philosophers here, our number is 646-435-7280. It can be a big question, like what's the meaning of life, or something small, maybe an ethical question that comes up in everyday life. Our number is 646-435-7280. You can also tweet to us, or if you'd like to remain anonymous, you can always send us a message at Instagram. Our handle for Twitter and Instagram, it's the same one, at @allofitwnyc. Well, since our first caller brought up politics, Denise, I want to throw one to you that's been in the news lately, an ethical question. I'm not sure it's philosophical, or it might be on that borderline. Bob Woodward. It came out in the recorded conversations he had with President Trump that the president knew of the severity of coronavirus and COVID-19, and Bob Woodward had this recorded. months and months before everybody went into lockdown and shutdown. So what is I guess the philosophical question is his duty to his profession as a journalist, or did he have a duty to greater mankind? It's a little bit like the trolley question. What do you think?
Good. I'm not sure that I'm situated such to know enough of the details to have a clear idea of what the specific obligations would be, but certainly we have obligations to disseminate information, right, that we think is relevant.
Mm-hmm.
One challenge, of course, is, right, what kinds of consequences, what will follow from that, right? What kind of difference will I make if I pass on that information? And so I don't know, Woodward's thinking, right, and what kind of calculations he was making regarding how to release that information. I mean, of course, because he has actually released the information, but mm-hmm. timing-wise, of course, that's a challenge. But there is something to be said about, right, transparency and what my obligations are. Even if it's my authority to make a decision, say, right, but can I be open in the reasons for making my decision, and can I be transparent mm-hmm. about that process and acknowledging that, yes, it's my decision, and but I can still kind of be accountable, right, through my transparency and through my reasoning to others as a way of sort of allowing them to participate in that process.
Yeah, another chapter in your book is called... go ahead.
Do you mind if I add one little thing here?
Of course.
A lot of people who object to Woodward's decision to hold on to this information about the, sneakiness or duplicity of the president think that if he had spoken up earlier, Trump would have handled the pandemic differently, or he would have been subject to some pressure which led him to handle the pandemic differently. But I think there is good reason to doubt that, right? Because he's not especially responsive to criticism, especially criticism from, liberal journalists. But yeah, just my two cents.
Ian, another chapter in your book is called "If Someone Buys Me a Drink at the Bar, Do I Owe Them Anything?" Mm-hmm. Does everything that is of value come down to a quid pro quo, and how do you know when a gift is a gift?
Yeah, that was funny. I mean, I think all of the philosophers at the table that day were just sort of very vigorously shaking our heads. No, just because some random guy at the bar buys you a drink, you don't have to talk to him or be nice or buy him anything back. But I think a lot of our moral thinking is guided by some sort of central metaphors. And one of those metaphors is a kind of accounting metaphor. We owe people things. We incur debts to people. We forgive those debts and so on. And so I think when we're tempted to use that kind of accounting metaphor, we need to be really, really careful because on the one hand, it can make it really easy for people to sort of place, goofy obligations on us by just giving us stuff, making us mm-hmm. indebted to them. And on the other hand, it's kind of weirdly unambitious, do I really think that all of my, moral obligations in the world consist in just kind of keeping my ledgers balanced and, balancing any harm I do to somebody with an equal amount of, benefit? That seems like, not the most morally ambitious way to live. So, I think the person who was asking this question was sort of guided by that metaphor and, pointing to the weaknesses of using that metaphor to reason about moral problems. Hopefully was helpful.
Let's go to Slavic Online 2, who's calling in from Manhattan. And Denise, this might be one for you to field, given your area of study. Slavic, thanks for calling in.
Yes, I just was listening, and it sort of connects to what was just said. I was wondering, what's the connection between morality and philosophy?
the connection.
How they influence each other, or how they are, what's the connection here?
Yes, he wants to know, are philosophy and morality connected, or are they separate things? Denise, why don't you go for that?
Sure. So moral theory, ethical reasoning, ethical theorizing is central to philosophical practice. It has been from the get-go, I think. So I think one of the ways in which philosophical reasoning gets going is when we step back and think about our lives and how our lives are going and what makes for a good life, and also looking at the world around us and trying to figure out how we fit into that world and what we want that world to look like. So yes, I think morality and philosophy are intimately related, and kind of one of the fundamental ways I think a lot of individuals start thinking about philosophy and raising philosophical questions for themselves, for their own lives, and for a lot of everyday kind of interactions, right? When we think about friendship or we think about raising children, right? Those are all ethical questions that philosophers, you know, take up and consider in really rigorous ways.
Let's check in with David from Manhattan on line one. He has some thoughts about objectivity and subjectivity. David, thanks for calling in.
Thank you so much, you guys. I want to also thank you for having this program. It's really exciting because I think philosophy is, like, I think so sorely missed in our society on a day-to-day basis. And I, you know, it's one of the ways I approach my life. So I'm just, you know, so grateful for this. But one of the things I run into is the idea about objectivity. This is the idea of, you know, a Godhead being able to see everything. And so ultimately, you know, that's impossible because, you know, even in science that they're finding out ultimately, it seems like everything is ultimately subjective. But that doesn't mean we don't throw out, you know, the rigors of analyzing. And then I've come to the point to understand that it's our human form that helps us define what sort of world we want to have from a philosophical perspective on the contemplation of what is virtue. And the reason why we want to have virtue is so that way we can, you know, be able to interact with our society and our cosmos. Because if we don't have virtue, then it's chaos. But I wanted to see what your thoughts were about the myth of objectivity and its impossibility, ultimately. And I think that's where the scientific method comes in for us. It gives us a way to, you know, add to the contemplation and our place in the cosmos and in our world and with each other.
Ian, what do you think? Let's dive in here and see if your thoughts on this, objectivity and subjectivity.
Great. Yeah, there's a lot there. I mean, I wouldn't go so far as to say that objectivity is impossible, but I think you're right to point to the fact that at least some forms of objectivity aren't always necessarily desirable. They don't always necessarily bring us closer to the truth or make our beliefs more reasonable. So, you know, for example, one thing that some people sometimes mean by an objective person or an objective reasoner is somebody who doesn't have any skin in the game, somebody who doesn't have any material stake in the truth or falsity of some, you know, proposition. And, well, sometimes not having skin in the game can make you, you know, get a sort of better grip on the situation. You know, we hope that judges in courtrooms, for example, don't, you know, stand to gain or lose from how a case is decided. But on the other hand, sometimes having skin in the game, you know, being non-objective in that sense is like a good thing. you know, when it comes to political questions, for example, a lot of the times people think that, you know, people who are members of oppressed social groups or people who sort of live in a day-to-day way with some social problem with, you know, poverty, racism, whatever it is, that they have a kind of better bead on the phenomenon than, you know, people who live at some remove from that problem. So, yeah, I think that's, I think we probably agree, at least to that extent, that, you know, objectivity isn't always and in every form like a desirable thing.
My guests are Ian Olazoff, author of the new book, Ask a Philosopher, and Denise Vigani, assistant professor in philosophy at Seton Hall University. We're taking your calls and answering some of those big philosophical questions. Our lines are open at 646-435-7280. More calls and more with Ian and Denise after the break. This is all of it. My guests this hour, Ian Olazoff, author of the new book, Ask a Philosopher, and Denise Vigani, assistant professor in philosophy at Seton Hall University. We are taking your calls and asking and thinking about some philosophical questions. Our number is 646-435-7280. So, Ian, you have a chapter in your book called What is Love? But instead of answering that question, you ask another one, which is, when does it make sense for one person to love another? Why is this a preferable question for you?
Yeah, I actually started thinking about this, I think, really seriously when my brother got married a couple of years ago and asked me to say something at his wedding. And I was like, oh, no, I don't have any useful philosophical thoughts about love. So I tried to come up with something good. I think the what is love question can be helpful. It can give us some clarity, but it's largely a terminological question. It's largely a matter of, you know, how we choose to define or clarify this sort of vague word. But the question, when it makes sense to love another person, isn't a definitional or terminological question. And I think also brings in this whole sort of suite of interesting philosophical problems having to do with when emotions or clusters of emotions sort of fit a situation or are appropriate or make sense in a situation and when they don't. So, I think that's one of the reasons why I kind of wanted to change the subject, at least in the book, is that it moves away from definitional and terminological stuff to I think meatier substantive stuff.
Denise, here's one from your website. Is patience a virtue?
Yes.
good, yeah. So, I mean, I think patience is one of those things where we're told, right? It's a statement, right? Patience is a virtue. We know that. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, we can see how waiting too long, right? Being too submissive, being too passive, that's not a good thing. And so where does that virtue lie? And for me, right, I think that there is, I mean, Ian just mentioned appropriateness, right, fittingness for emotions, right? There's an appropriate amount of time, right, for certain ends. And being sensitive to that and being responsive to allowing time to unfold appropriately for particular ends is an important aspect of living a good human life. It allows us to pursue goals. It allows us to let things come to us while also insisting that we maintain some sense of, okay, that's too long, right? And I can mm-hmm. I can kind of cut things off and not fall back into passivity.
Let's go to Gregory from Jersey City on line two. Gregory has a question about philosophy as much as a philosophical question. Hi, Gregory. Thanks for calling All of It.
Hi. Can you hear me okay?
We hear you great.
Mm-hmm. Oh, great. Our resident philosophers, thank you very much for taking my call. Just familiar with the idea of a dualistic versus an absolute standpoint when it comes to God, and an absolute standpoint infers that there is no divisibility between God and man. And from that standpoint, I mean, how does that affect your ideas of objectivity and subjectivity?
Ian, you want to take that?
Yeah, sure. I can take this. I'm not a religious person. I was really religious for a few months in high school, but not religious these days. But I think that one of the ways of framing this question that I think can appeal to, you know, both people who believe in God and people who don't, has to do with sort of getting rid of the sort of tendency to see different parts of reality as sort of totally unrelated to each other. You know, the mind and the body, the evaluative and the descriptive, that sort of thing. And, you know, what can you do to kind of, you know, overcome that tendency? You know, I think there are a lot of different, you know, sort of approaches that philosophers have taken throughout time to sort of keep in mind the sort of connectedness of all things somehow to live with or in light of that fact or cope with that fact somehow. I mean, I'm not sure what the best answer to this question is, although I think it helps at least to just sort of periodically remind ourselves of the, you know, contingent empirical connections between all the things on Earth. you know, we think of the a natural world is separate from the artificial, but the artificial world is built on the natural world. We think of ourselves as separate from non-human animals, but, you know, we are non-human animals with just a couple of tweaks. So I think just sort of bearing in mind those, you know, contingent or factual or causal connections between things that we tend to think of as separate can be sort of healthy and can have that that effect that, you know, philosophers and theologians have desired in the past of sort of bearing in mind the connectedness or the unity of all things.
Let's go to line one. Jim is calling us from the Jersey Shore. Jim, thanks for calling All of It.
Hi. I'm not wearing a mask. I hope that's okay.
No, just joking. Are you alone? Are you by yourself?
Yeah, I am.
Then
it's
okay.
Me and the computer and the telephone, radio. I have more of a comment than a question. I was a Buddhist monk when I was younger in Thailand, and the Buddha had a teaching that if you ask a, he wouldn't answer a question that was sort of philosophical. He would only answer a question that would help you to relieve yourself from suffering. For and as an example of this was my teacher. There was an American professor that asked him, "What are your ideas about reincarnation?" And his response was, Thai word is kigya dop. Translated, it means I'm too lazy to answer that. It's he was saying what we would say is that's too much trouble to answer. Hmm. So my teacher would not entertain something that would be just a sort of a philosophical one, because Buddhism is about relieving one from suffering, and asking a question directly about that was something that either the Buddha or my teacher would entertain. So I just wanted to make that reflection.
Well, we thank you for calling in. We really appreciate it. Ian, I do want to, as we start to wrap up, I want to ask you something that's it's a little bit silly. But I'm interested in it because it's in your book. You have the question, is ketchup a smoothie? And, you know, there's a lot of different versions on this question. It's like, is a hot dog a sandwich? Are these silly questions, or is there something else you're trying to get to here?
Why not both, right? I remember when the kid asked this question, I mean, she was maybe about 9 years old and, you know, stopped by the booth with, I think it was her mom. And mom was like, oh, do you have a philosophical question? And the kid thought for a second and asked whether ketchup is a smoothie. And the mom said, no, like a real philosophical question. But all of the philosophers, they were like, no, that is a real philosophical question. That's a good one. I think one of the things that philosophy can do is sort of press against the limits of concepts that we use in everyday life, and sort of show that sort of outside of a kind of narrow range of application, these concepts become sort of slippery and difficult to work with. And maybe it's a matter of taste, but I just kind of I just really enjoy that experience of being kind of unsettled by thinking that, like, oh, wait, I thought I knew what ketchup was. I thought I knew what a smoothie was, but maybe I don't, you know. And these sort of, you know, sillier or less or more trivial concepts like ketchup and smoothie are maybe, you know, a safer way of having that experience than, you know, asking yourself what knowledge is or what the difference is between right and wrong. I mean, I think the one very brief version of an answer to this question is that asking questions like this sort of encourages us to impose a kind of uniformity on the meaning of, you know, a word that we have in everyday English, like smoothie, to look for a definition which applies, you know, always and everywhere. And that's not how words usually work. But, you know, asking these sorts of questions can change how we use words. So, you know, it's maybe a little glib, but maybe true to say that, yeah, ketchup wasn't a smoothie before anyone asked that question, but maybe it is now.
There are a lot of more questions to consider and to think about in his new book, Ask a Philosopher. Ian Olazoff, thank you for being with us.
Thank you. This is fabulous.
And Denise Vigani, Assistant Professor of Philosophy at Seton Hall University. Thanks for joining us as well.
Thank you so much for having me.